Well, morning, everybody. It is nice to be here. This exhortation, in fact, was written for the new year about 18 months ago, but was never used. And I was looking for something today. And so this is why the readings are unusual as such. I thought about it from the reason it was interesting. Graham spoke about we look back to remember the events surrounding the death of our Lord. But this really is based on the idea of people making plans for the future. It's what people do at the beginning of a new year. They make plans for the future. And the commonly voiced New Year's resolutions are often already broken, and attention is turned to planning the summer holiday, the next house move or new car. These things may be seen as necessary, but they often include a strong element of self being served. And so in their set of readings for that New Year day, when we come to Genesis and 26 and verse 5, we're looking at the events surrounding the death of Abraham. They're well known to us. And God said of Abraham, "Abraham obeyed me and did everything I required of him, keeping my commands, my decrees, and my instructions." It is interesting to note that Abraham was a man who planned for the future. I suspect with a different ethic in mind than the society in which we live. For in Genesis 25 and verse 5, we read, "Abraham left everything he owned to Isaac. But while he was still living, he gave gifts to the sons of his concubines and sent them away from his son Isaac to the land of the east." This appears to me to be a sensible plan to reduce any conflict over Isaac receiving the inheritance. It would seem probable, knowing the character of Abraham, that the gifts Abraham bestowed upon the sons of his concubines would have enabled them to resettle in the lands of the east in comfort. The situation that arises between Jacob and Esau takes a very different tone. We know the story well. Esau proves to be a man of the moment, taking a short-term view and not considering the value of what he had. In Genesis 25 and at verse 29, we read, "Once when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau came in from the open country, famished. He said to Jacob, 'Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I am famished. That is why he's also called Edom. Jacob replied, "First sell me your birthright." "Look, I'm about to die," Esau said. "What good is the birthright to me?" But Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. He ate and drank, then got up and left. So Esau despised his birthright. Esau was the man of the moment. Jacob was the man of the future, exploiting a situation for his own benefit. I find it hard to think that God was in his mind at this moment in time. Their father was a very different character. In Genesis 26, we're told there was a time of adversity. There was famine in the land. It would have appeared that it could have been more favourable for Isaac to go to Egypt. So why land up with the Philistines? In Genesis 26 and at verse 2, we read, "The Lord appeared to Isaac and said, 'Do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land where I tell you to live. Stay in this land for a while, and I will bless you.' But that is what happened. That's the good consequences of listening to the word of the Lord. Then the situation became difficult. Isaac prospered and was perceived as a threat to the Philistines, and he was sent away. Also, in his prosperity, would he, maybe like me, be tempted to remain? I find it interesting that water is at the heart of the following narrative. When Isaac is separated from the Philistines, it's through conflict over water rights. Then coming to Beersheba, where he settles, where he builds an altar and finds water. He's been separated by the Philistines by water and found a new place in which to dwell by water. Maybe as the waters of baptism should spiritually separate us from the world. Isaac was a man with his mind set on what God has promised. And this takes us to Psalm 31. In embracing the contents of Psalm 31, we are once again entering into the life and the mind of David, a man like many, flawed but faithful. David is a man in trouble here. In Psalm 31 and at verse 2, he says, his cry is, "Turn your ear to me, come quickly to my rescue." In verse 4, he says, "Free me from the trap that is set for me." In verse 9, "Be merciful to me, O Lord, for I am in distress." And in verse 13, "For I hear the slander of many. There is terror on every side. They conspire to take my life." It's a desolate chorus from a man in real trouble, some would say at the end of his tether. But in faith, he knows where to turn. For back in that psalm in verse 1, we read, "In you, O Lord, I have taken refuge." In verse 6, "I trust in the Lord." And in verse 14, "But I trust in you, O Lord. I say you are my God." And in verse 21, "Praise be to the Lord, for he showed his wonderful love to me when I was in a besieged city." In those depths of despair, he declares his future. His salvation is in God. This event, David recalls, appears to be the time when he was fleeing from Saul. He went to the city of Keilah and saved it from the Philistines' forces, only to learn that due to threats from Saul, the citizens of that city would hand over David and his men to Saul, so they fled. Those words recalled in Psalm 31 have a powerful impact upon David. In verse 21, he says, "Praise be to the Lord, for he showed his wonderful love to me when I was in a besieged city. In my alarm, I said, 'I am cut off from your sight.' Yet you heard my cry for mercy when I called to you for help." David received of God's wonderful love. In so doing, he had to listen to what he was told and act upon that information. These events are recorded in 1 Samuel 23 and at verse 14, where we read, "David stayed in the desert strongholds and in the hills of the desert city of Ziph. Day after day, Saul searched for him, but God did not give David into his hands. At this time, through faith in God, his safety was assured." We, like David, may experience adversity in our lives, but in a different way. There may be practical and physical circumstances in our lives that will challenge our faith and test our endurance in this life. We may well be in despair of what we see going on in the world around us. Then we should take to heart the exhortation of David, drawn from his experience in the closing verses of Psalm 31 and at verse 23. Love the Lord, all his saints. The Lord preserves the faithful, but the proud he pays back in full. Be strong and take heart, all you who hope in the Lord. In the times of testing, we must rest upon the hope that we have, as did David, and it caused him to pen from experience the wonderful opening of the following psalm, Psalm 32. Blessed is he whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. Blessed the man whose sin the Lord does not count against him, and in whose spirit there is no deceit. And it is that spirit of deceit that we encounter in our third reading in Matthew 16. And at verse 1, we read, the Pharisees and the Sadducees came to Jesus and tested him by asking him to show them a sign from heaven. One may ask, why? Because they were in both instances what we may describe as the people of the book. Their religious outlook was based on and practiced through the writings and the rabbinical exposition of the law delivered through Moses. Their question was insincere. They were not seeking the truth. Jesus tells them they will not be given a sign, because in Matthew 16 and at verse 4 we read, a wicked and adulterous generation looks for a miraculous sign, but none will be given it except the sign of Jonah. Note the word given. It is an action, to hand something over, to offer advice or give a gift. This requires the receiver to pay attention. You cannot judge whether advice is good or bad unless you listen. You cannot discern what a gift is and is intended for unless you unwrap it and inspect it. So the sign of Jonah is important for all who will receive it. It was and is the sign of a man of God going to the depths of the earth, as it were, to rise again, so that a wicked and adulterous generation has an opportunity to repent. All of this foreshadowing the work of Jesus, a sign that looked to the future. Part of this exhortation is about to look to the future in our daily lives and being prepared. And I think if we are honest, we often slip up. How many times do we open a bag when we are out for that useful piece of clothing or equipment, only to find it is not there? So when we come to the disciples in Matthew 16 and at verse 5, when they went across the lake, the disciples forgot to take bread. When Jesus cautions them to be aware of the leaven of the Pharisees, they themselves make a connection to the forgotten bread. I wondered why. The word used for bread in this context is the Greek artos, which means bread that is raised. So one may understand why they made that connection. The word used for leaven in the Greek is zumai, which means to ferment. The bread became the completed product through the addition of the leaven. Jesus then draws out for his disciples and for us an important lesson. He reminds them of the time when he fed the 4,000 and the 5,000. Jesus is always able to provide the forgotten, to make up the shortfall, as it were. It is a strong prompt in verse 8, where Jesus says, you of little faith, what of the leaven, that which raises up? Well, they listened. And their understanding became that Jesus was warning them in verse 12 against the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Could this leaven affect us? In Luke 12 and at verse 1, we read, "Be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy." I would like to think, if we are honest with ourselves, that is something that can affect each one of us if we stray from the teaching of Jesus and his example. One of the primary issues throughout the ages has been the identity of Jesus. It's an issue which Jesus raises in Matthew 16 and at verse 13. Who do people say the Son of Man is? And there are a selection of opinions. In verse 14, we read, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah or one of the prophets." Multiple identities. And that has been my experience in my Christian walk. Jesus has been presented as a radical revolutionary, a person centered on contending with the politics of our age, a person contending for the downtrodden of society. All of this with little or no mention of the gospel of salvation which he delivered. It is faithful Peter who furnishes the definitive answer in Matthew 16. "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." That response elucidates a reply from Jesus, which delivers a great blessing and also a responsibility, and it reinforces the identity of Peter. Jesus says, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." Where did such a revelation come from? We are told it comes from God. And I would suggest that Peter had been in the company of Jesus for the last 3 years. And that conclusion had come through that experience of a God-blessed relationship in his life. Jesus says in John 5 and at verse 19, "I tell you the truth. The Son of Man can do nothing by himself. He can do only what he sees his Father doing. Because whatever the Father does, the Son does also." We cannot say for sure, but it is not unreasonable to see the teaching that Peter had received from Jesus as a revelation, because of everything Jesus said and did was at the behest of his Father. What of Peter? He's not just the faithful disciple, the faithful disciple stroke apostle. He is now a rock. How has that change come about? Well, I think it's this. He said from his heart, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Peter is now a true confessor of faith. He believes in his heart and his mind and his very soul who Jesus really is. This is the rock on which the church is built. Not the man, but the true confession of faith. So as once again, we draw near to the bread and wine, where are we in all of this? If we, like Peter, can truly confess what Jesus means to us. Paul wrote to the Ephesians in chapter 2 and at verse 19, "Consequently, you are no longer foreigners and aliens, but fellow citizens with God's people and members of God's household, built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, with Christ himself as the cornerstone. In him, the whole building is joined together and rises to become a holy temple in the Lord. And in him, you too are being built together to become a dwelling in which God lives by his Spirit."